come to the unpredictable part of the service. I'm hoping that some folks have brought in something to share with us, a reading, a poem, a song, a story. I brought in a bunch of books of poetry, but I've kind of don't know how to get them to you, other than to just pass them around, and if anybody sees anything that grabs them, that they would like to read, go for it. So, I'm just going to do this. And if I don't have any more left, I'm sorry. Just, if you don't want to pass along, that's fine. But I will start off with something that is not a poem. In fact, it's a newspaper article that I read just a couple of days ago. I grew up Jewish, spent several years studying in Israel, and have some very strong opinions about the Israel-Palestinian conflict, which I'm not going to get into. But there was this article, an Associated Press article, that I just found very, very inspiring. It's Dateline Detroit. Many Jews consider Christmas Day an opportunity to serve their community while Christian neighbors celebrate their holiday. This year, what's also known as Mitzvah Day in southeastern Michigan is getting an added boost for Muslims. For the first time, about 40 Muslims are expected to join the 900 Jews for what they call their largest annual day of volunteering. Leaders say it's a small but significant step in diffusing tensions and promoting goodwill between the religions, particularly on a day that is sacred to Christianity, the third Abrahamic faith. Mitzvah Day, a nearly 20-year tradition in the Detroit area, also practiced in other communities, is so named because mitzvah means commandment in Hebrew, and is also generally translated to mean a good deed. The Jewish groups organize Mitzvah Day, which consists of volunteers helping 48 local service agencies with tasks such as feeding the hungry and delivering toys to children. Victor Beg, the chairman of the Islamic Council, said he was seeking a public way for the two faiths to build bridges of understanding and cooperation, which led to joining the Mitzvah Day's efforts. Not only are Muslims and Jews available to serve on Christmas Day, but leaders also recognize a shared commitment to community service. Charity in Judaism is known as tzedakah. In Islam, it's called zakat. We felt it was a perfect activity for people to be getting together like this because you work side by side with one or two other people as you're moving boxes. The grassroots connection builds relationships on a personal level. Whatever happens in the Middle East, we have no control over it, Beg said. But here, our children go to the same schools. We work together. We need to focus on building and inclusive community. So I thought that was very inspiring. And on that note, I'd like to invite anybody, everybody, to share with us. Ray.
Along that line, Roy, last Christmas, the most recent last, but the year before last Christmas, I went to the National Soup Kitchen and the people who were serving the Temple.
I have something you're going to have to bear with. I have my glasses case, and there are no glasses.
Yes, I just well, maybe a Christmas miracle will appear.
Do you want to use the bottom of mine?
Sure. Try and see. We'll see how it works.
It's just pure man.
The subject is fact that we are all so certain that we are right. And sometimes we are mistaken. So let's see if I can do without. Neville Chamberlain was a Unitarian and a member of a prominent English Unitarian family, but we rarely see him listed amongst the members of our faith group as one of our more enlightened souls. We rarely find him listed as one of our members who made a mark on history, but he did make a mark on history. He and his name, however, will forever be associated with the word appeasement. Because he was wrong in his judgment of Adolf Hitler's character and intentions, and because his policy failed, we hold him in some degree responsible for the disaster that was World War II. His policy was peace, and no one will find that wrong. The means he chose to implement his policy were, however, fatally flawed, and no one was a more severe critic of those means than Winston Churchill, who succeeded Chamberlain as Prime Minister on the 10th of May, 1940, the very day that Hitler's Nazis began their two-month sweep over Luxembourg, Belgium, Holland, and France. Neville Chamberlain, when he left office on the 10th of May, had no idea that he had but a few months to live. But he died of cancer on November 9th, 1940, and on November 12th, Churchill rose in the House of Commons to deliver a tribute that reminds us of the fallibility of our judgments. I'm going to try to read a portion of that, and this is where probably the trouble begins. At the lych gate, we may all pass our own conduct and our own judgments under a searching review. It is not given to human beings, happily for them, for otherwise life would be intolerable, to foresee or to predict to any large extent the unfolding course of events. In one phase, men seem to have been right, in another, they seem to have been wrong. Then, again, a few years later, when the perspective of time has lengthened, all stands in a different setting. There is a new proportion. The only guide to a man is his conscience. The only shield to his memory is the rectitude and sincerity of his actions. It is very imprudent to walk through life without this shield because we are so often mocked by the failure of our hopes and the upsetting of our calculations. But with this shield, however the fates may play, we march always in the ranks of honor. Whatever else history may or may not say about these terrible and tremendous years, we can be sure that Neville Chamberlain acted with perfect sincerity according to his lights and strove to the utmost of his capacity and authority to save the world from the awful, devastating struggle in which we are now engaged.
But I read several years ago an article by a man called Jim Collins, and he was a professor at Stanford University and later became a researcher for business and economics. But this article that he wrote told about him being a student at one time, a graduate student at Stanford, and one of his teachers, and he thought, I mean, he was getting all A's, he was doing wonderful things, he was always busy. And one of the teachers one time told him that he was very undisciplined. And he was really taken aback by that because he thought he was doing really marvelously well and his grade showed it. And she said, you are doing too many things. And she said, you are undisciplined and you're not paying attention to what's really important. And what she said really was, you need to think about the new year and the things that you need to stop doing. And usually when we make New Year's resolutions, we think of, we make a list of all the things we're going to do. And she suggested that he do the opposite. Think about what you should stop doing. And among those things are the things that you need to think about what you're doing. Is it important to you? Do you have a passion for it? Is it something that you have a talent for? And I thought that was a really good message that has stayed with me for the past 3 or 4 years, so I thought maybe you want to ponder that. Thank you.
This is W.S. Merwin from The Shadow of Sirius, and the poem is called Inheritance. At my elbow on the table, it lies open, as it has done for a good part of these 30 years, ever since my father died, and it passed into my hands, this Webster's New International Dictionary of the English Language of 1922, on Indian paper, which I was always forbidden to touch for fear I would somehow damage its delicate pages, heavy in their binding, this color of wet sand on which thin waves hover. When it was printed, he was 26. They had not been married 4 years. He was a country preacher in a one-store town, and I suppose a man came to the door one day peddling this new dictionary on fine paper like the Bible at an unrepeatable price, and it seemed it would represent a distinction just to own it, confirming something about him that he could not even name. Now its cover is worn as though it had been carried on journeys across the mountains and deserts of the earth, but it has been here, beside me, the whole time. What has frayed it like that, loosening it, gnawing at it, all through these years? I know I must have used it much more than he did, but always with care and indeed affection, turning the pages patiently in search of meaning.
Time there's been much discussion and lots of writing about what unites us as an association with the diversity of our beliefs. And, the last commission, the Unitarian Universalist Association, working title was "What is the unity in our community?" It was later changed to "Engaging our theological diversity." And I've thought a lot about this question, and I know my covenant group has heard me speak to this, and it continues to move me. And they asked in the commission to as much as possible pass on that question: what unites us in our diversity? And my answer to that is love. That the roots of Unitarian Universalism go deep from its early Christian and Judeo roots of the God of love and salvation for all, and our modern day manifestation from the diversity from humanism to paganism and Christianity and Buddhism, I think is again a manifestation of love. And I offer in that same spirit, if you will, two covenants that are used widely in our Unitarian Universalist congregations. In fact, when they surveyed, I was very, very surprised by this. The group that did this, the last commission of appraisal of Unitarian Universalists, surveyed the 1,000 congregations that make up the richness of the fellowships and congregations and churches throughout our country and Canada. And they found that of those who use a covenant regularly in the service, and that's about one quarter of us, over half of them use one or the other or a variation of these two covenants. So with that, I'd like to read both of them to you. They're in our singing the living tradition. The first one is by the Reverend James Velo Blake. It was written in 1894, and it's 473 in your hymnal. Love is the spirit of this church, and service its law. This is our great covenant, to dwell together in peace, to seek the truth in love, and to help one another. The second one is by F. Gunswald Williams. He was a Universalist minister, and this was penned in 1933. And as I say, this one and as the previous one, there are variations. As we are a free faith, that each congregation has almost done a little variation. They've dropped this word, they've modified this one, they've added this, and I would have modified a little. This one I will read. I'll leave out the last two, which has been the tradition for most to use this. As I say, this is by Reverend L. Griswold Williams. Love is a doctrine of this church, the quest of truth, its sacrament, and service is its prayer. To dwell together in peace, to seek knowledge in freedom, to serve human need. And I want to suggest that, you know, both of these begin with love. And so I think there is a strong sort of fellowship around this this concept. And the final one is taken from the Cathedral of the World, which is by Forest Church, who most would say is certainly the most prolific Unitarian Universalist theologian of our time. He just recently died. He was the minister of the All Souls Church in New York City for over 30 years. And the Cathedral of the World is his last book. He spoke about, he actually had maybe three last books because he got kind of extensions, you know. And he said, well, I'm sort of embarrassed I'm still here, but you know, having said that, let me put out another book to you. Of it, and this really is a compilation of many of his thinking. Just Bob sharing about Neville Chamberlain, one of the loves that I think they shared with Bob is he was very much a historian of Unitarian Universalism, but in a much wider sense, and he's written very eloquently of that, and some of that is contained in this book. The Cathedral of the World is his analogy, which he has been speaking about for many, many years. In fact, he wrote a book with Jarn Burens, who was the sort of now three presidents of the association back. And he uses the analogy of one light, many windows. And he says the one light comes from the Unitarian side of our denomination, which is the unifying and the universalist perspective of many lights having many diversities that all come under the same roof. And so with that analogy, you can make up your picture of what the one light is. This is from the last paragraph of his book. I don't anticipate that I, as a distinct individual, will be any more conscious of God or of my participation in God after I die than I was before. All I know is that the miracle we participate in daily, the miracle of breathing and thinking and acting and falling and failing and loving and dying, is not wholly haphazard. Neither is it a discrete, bounded by a distinct and absolute beginning and ending. We are all part of something larger, something ongoing, something eternal, inscrutable, perhaps even unto itself. Reflecting on that light that shines through my religious window, the more I contemplate the mystery, the more reverent I become, the more understanding and undemanding of final answers, the more accepting of all that is and all that will be. Forest Church.
May I have one of the books that Roy passed out, preferably a poetry book? It seems to have been lost. Thank you. I was sitting there thinking about this. I kind of did a little research yesterday trying to find something to read because I really do like to participate, and nothing was hitting me. And so I came unprepared this morning. And I was sitting there thinking that, you know, none of us knows what's going to happen in the next moment at all. You know, we may think we're going to lunch with a friend or going to work or, you know, going home to take a nap or something like that, but we really don't know what's going to happen. And a lot of the times when I'm choosing a book or a piece of music or something like that, I just kind of open it up randomly and just read something. And I don't know if it's going to have relevance or not, but I just do it. And it helps me to decide sometimes on the book that I might buy, because I'll open to a page and go, oh, this is cool. You know, I don't know anything else that's going on in the book, but I've read maybe even just a sentence that really strikes me. So I was hoping the books would shift over, but they didn't. They just got lost. And that was very gracious, because I understand that these potpourri services can be a little daunting. It's not easy to get up here. My feet are actually like shaking a little bit. But I know most of you, and even if I don't know you, there are a lot of friendly faces out there, so I trust that you don't judge me too harshly. And I just open to this page, and I'll just read it. Could I borrow some glasses?
These are magnifying, aren't you?
Very,
I think there's a theme here. We were blinded and then there were lights.
Oh, this is good. Okay, this is from the book Ordinary Lies by Robert Duffy. And it's a poem called Letter to a Son at War.
I just read that. So funny. I'm just going to get up there, but I'm too shy. So that's
okay. I'll do it for you. I know. I thought of you this morning. No, you needn't answer. It's just that I thought of you. I was in the loft to throw down the hay. The first bale broke and blossomed wide as if the flowers dead and pressed inside had come alive again. Dust rose on the air and the sun struck swords of light through knots and gaps between the boards. And then I saw you crouching in the ghastly white of slow descending flares, your many shadows shifting, dancing on the rhythm of the fall, your face as delicate and dangerous as a looking glass. I threw down two more bales and looked again, but the salt wave of distance troubled my eye like heat above a pavement. So I went down the ladder to finish the chores I would have sent you to do if you were still here. The cows all turned their time dark eyes to see their hay, or perhaps to see if I were you, or if you were me. Cows, who's to say? I'm told they're worshipped in some places, and I wondered, half seriously, if I might try to pray to them, except I couldn't imagine what I ought to say. Thinking now, something simple, perhaps a bedtime prayer from childhood might even be enough. Do you know one? There, you see what it comes to. Words carefully packaged and sent away, not knowing whether they'll arrive or what they'll mean if they do arrive. Except I know I never meant this. I never meant to send my complaints into a desperate war. One labored page, then waking late to wonder whatever did I intend. Let me offer this instead, a bargain of sorts. If you will find me changed when you return, only this, nothing more, nothing difficult like love. If you will do it, I will engage to search your face for wounds to be regretful of.
Like Anya, I came unprepared, and thank you, Roy, for bringing books. I had sort of thought about doing something and ended up having my granddaughter all day yesterday, so I didn't get anything picked out. But I think fate or whatever put this book in my hands and this poem caught my eye. This is selected poems of Langston Hughes, and this one is called Keep Your Hand on the Plow, Hold On. Out of war it came, bloody and terrible, but it came. Some there were, as always, who doubted that the war would end right, that the slaves would be free, or that the Union would stand. But now we know how it all came out. Out of the darkest days for a people and a nation, we know now how it came out. There was light when the battle clouds rolled away. There was a great wooded land and men united as a nation. America is a dream. The poet says it was a promise. The people say it is promises that will come true. The people do not always say things out loud, nor write them down on paper. The people often hold great thoughts in their deepest hearts, and sometimes only blunderingly express them. Haltingly and stumbling say them, and faultily put them into practice. The people do not always understand each other, but there is, somewhere there, always the trying to understand, and the trying to say, you are a man, together we are building our land. America, land created in common, dream nourished in common. Keep your hand on the plow. Hold on. If the house is not yet finished, don't be discouraged, builder. If the fight is not yet won, don't be weary, soldier. The plan and the pattern is here, woven from the beginning into the warp and woof of America. All men are created equal. No man is good enough to govern another man without that other's consent. Better die free than live slaves. Who said those things? Americans. Who owns those words? America. Who is America? You, me, we are America. To the enemy who would conquer us from without, we say no. To the enemy who would divide and conquer us from within, we say no. Freedom, brotherhood, democracy. To all the enemies of these great words, we say no. A long time ago, an enslaved people heading toward freedom made up a song. Keep your hand on the plow, hold on. That plow plowed a new furrow across the field of history. Into that furrow, the freedom seed was dropped. From that seed, a tree grew, is growing, will ever grow. That tree is for everybody, for all America, for all the world. May its branches spread and its shelter grow until all traces and all, I'm sorry, until all races and all people know its shade. Keep your hand on the plow. Hold on.
Honestly, scarier than I thought it was. I did come prepared, but as this wonderful woman said, things don't always go according to plan. And the plan was that the person for whom I wrote this would be sitting there next to me, and it would be great when I read it and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But we heard those fateful words, "I'm just not ready for a relationship," last night. And all of you, based on your face, have heard those words before, or at least some of you have. But I thought if someone could dig down inside of me and get all this to come out, whether they were here or not, or whether it was still real or not, it should still be celebrated. So you guys get to hear it anyway. Here it goes. It could have been any day. We could have been anywhere. I could have been someone's grandfather, wrinkled and bald, or a little girl in pink with pigtails. And you? You could have been just you, or a tree, or a coin stamped with only your face and your fingerprints. Still, you would have been perfect. We could have been anybody on any day, but it happened on Christmas Eve. It happened just after you opened the bag with the blanket, and we looked at each other the way two friends look at each other when they know that they aren't going to be just two friends for much longer. And I fell in love with you without a word. This isn't a joke. It really could have been anywhere. We could have been any two people. We could have been two children on a playground swing set, and I would have jumped from the highest height to impress you. Or I could have been the sun, and you could be the green ivy that needs me to grow, or I could be the dirty dishwater, and you could be the soap that scatters me. It's been 2 days, 14 hours, and 57 minutes, and you just told me you were happy being single, and I'm sitting here reading your poem to a group of strangers because you're not here. You're not here. So it's been 2 days, 14 hours, and 57 minutes, and I still think you have a beautiful face and infectious laugh, and you can make me smile and hold it there for a really long time. And I imagine that you could make love to me like nobody else ever has, but all I want is to fall asleep next to you and wonder if this is what it feels like to be happy forever, or if we are all just fooling ourselves.
Thank you. I didn't come prepared to tell the story, but listening to the people ahead of me, I decided I'd tell this one. Since I retired, I've been tracking down lost relatives from the current generation, some my parents' generation. And weaving these stories together as I've discovered these people, and listening to some things said to you today, this kind of popped into my head. I grew up in Rhode Island. My father ran the state farm, which supplied the food for all the state institutions, from prisons to the state house of representatives. And we were a very rural family. We lived in a tiny village where my father grew up, my grandfather grew up, and my great-grandfather bought right after the Civil War. It was down a dirt road and down another dirt road. There were two houses beyond my grandmother's house before you reached the end of the electrical power line. She had the last home on that dirt road, and therefore it was kind of a public. People had come and gone. And I'm talking in the 30s. It was deep in the woods, very scattered, very poor subsistence farms. But it was a different community, and some of the things said here and some of the things I've been thinking about have struck me as one of those differences. One of the people I knew from the time I was old enough to be aware was a man by the name of Earl Johnson. He lived down Bob's Hill Road off Plainwoods Road in the middle of nowhere in a tiny little cottage in the woods. I never knew if he had any family. He was the man who delivered kerosene to all these little farms in the 30s, probably the 20s, 30s, and almost to 1950, I think. And when I was 5 or 6, I was spending a few days at my grandmother's in the summer, and Earl's old truck, I wish I could tell you what year it was, I can't. All I do remember is it had a crank-out windshield. Have you seen pictures of those? It had to be a 20-inch truck. And to support himself, he made his own kerosene tank, maybe a 300-gallon kerosene tank, welded it to the flatbed on his truck. And he drove through all these rural communities in western Rhode Island and into Connecticut, too, also, and delivered kerosene. And he would stop at my grandmother's once a week, and she'd buy a gallon or two because we had kerosene lanterns and we had a kerosene stove, and you had kerosene heaters if the wood furnace failed. So kerosene was kind of an important commodity back then. I can't remember what his price was. I wish I did. It was 10 cents a gallon. I don't remember. But he came into my grandmother's kitchen. He didn't knock on any doors. And I spent a good number of hours with him over the next few years. I pulled the truck into the driveway, walk into the farmhouse, find out if anybody was there. No one was, he'd walk out again. Sometimes the owner would leave a kerosene can on the back stoop. But he was welcome anywhere and trusted, and how can I say it? In some ways, he was part of the thread that tied this community together. Scattered. Think about not having a telephone, not having radio reception, not having a newspaper, not having a computer or a cell phone. That's what it was like out there. And since he knocked on every door within a wide radius, he kind of carried a lot of the community news. Well, when I was 5 or 6, he came to my grandmother's kitchen. He was a little round man, probably not much more than 5 feet tall, with a speech defect. You could understand him, but it was a little difficult. And he greeted me, and he turned to my grandmother, and he said, maybe Peter would like to ride with me on my rounds today. So my grandmother and I said, okay. And my grandmother made me a sandwich. She gave me an apple, and off we went. That 1927, I'll call it a Ford, had no springs left in the seats. It was a dirt road. So when you crank the windshield open to get some fresh air, it was dusty. And so for the next rest of the day, we must have stopped at 15 or 20 little farms. And if the people didn't know me, he'd introduce me as his grandson or Joe's boy, that's my dad's name. And I went on this trip with him many times until I was maybe 9 or 10. And I decided, no, I didn't want to do that. And there's one funny part of Earl's history that I'll tell, and then I'll wrap it up. I've been raised right, and if somebody had a deformity, you didn't mention it. You know what I mean. A lot of the older generation in that community were from World War I, and they were missing limbs and missing hands and missing ears among some of the population. But you didn't speak about it. But Earl was missing these three fingers on his left hand. And I was really curious. But I held my tongue for several rides. And finally, being maybe 6 by this time, I just couldn't stand any longer. And I said, Earl, how did you lose your fingers? What happened to your fingers? And now a little more background. In those days, people grew corn, not only for either for cattle feed or livestock feed or eat themselves, and they use the corn stalks for silage. And they use what they call the corn chopper to chop up the corn stalks. Have any of you tried to chop up a corn stalk? They are tough. They are just amazingly tough. And the equipment they had back in those days was they called it a corn chopper. Very dangerous piece of equipment. It was driven by a tractor takeoff, you know, a leather belt that hooked up to the drive wheel on a tractor. It was a long metal chute. Around it was an endless belt of chains, maybe 5 or 6 chains running in parallel, if you can imagine that. And the chains had little hooks on them. You threw the corn stalks onto the conveyor, I'll call it. The hooks would drag the corn stalk into a couple of whirling blades, also driven by the tractor drive, which would chop up the corn stalks, they reckon, and they then shovel them into the feed bins. Quite often, the corn chopper would get stalled. Keep in mind, these are farm boys from the 20s and 30s. They'd throw in too much corn, and it would jam. And they'd be true, and I've seen the scene when I was a boy. They'd stand around and look at each other. Well, a smart thing to do, a safe thing to do, is go over and turn the tractor off. Turn off the tractor. But that wasn't the manly thing to do. So the idea was, who was going to step up and look into that dark recess where the whirling blades were covered, and they were only going part-time because the leather belt was smoking and screeching on a tractor drive and the whole machine was shaking like a washing machine with unbalanced load. And they'd look in there and they'd see if they could see what was causing it so they could grab the corn stalk out. Well, the risk was, if you weren't quick enough, those hooks on the chain would grab your arm or your sleeve or whatever else was in there, and you could lose a hand or an arm. But that was the manly thing to do. Don't turn it off. So someone finally would step up and peer in there and then try to snatch that corn stalk out of the machine. And when they did successfully, the thing would just take off and everything was fine. with that background, Earl said, lost him in a corn chopper. So I knew what that meant. He'd been the guy that had stepped up, maybe in 1890, or was it his 60s when he was five, so in the late 1800s. And so I knew what that meant. But then I asked one more question, and it was, did you lose them all at once? And he said, no, one at a time. And I was too young and understanding the significance of that. I thought, oh, gee, that's kind of strange. But so when we finally got back to my grandmother's, and he dropped me off, I told her the story. She could hardly stand up for one. And she finally caught her breath and she said, well, Earl always was a slow learner. But on the serious side, what I like about my memory of Earl Johnson is this. I've tracked down two, and they're women. I mean, the men just don't make it into their 90s. Two great aunts of mine from that area, who I thought were long dead, amazed to find them still alive, and boy, sharper than I am, they're much better memory. They can tell you who was at Christmas dinner in 1943, if I remember it. No joke, and then give you their history. It's a stunning memory. They all remember. They both remember Earl Johnson. In fact, brought it up. Did you remember Earl Johnson? And I thought about that because this is 70 years ago. And he had no family, lived alone, was a strange man, by the way, not highly educated. But he was one of the ties that binds the community. People didn't have extra cars. He didn't drive down the road. They didn't stop at McDonald's. They lived on their farm all day, every day. And if they needed something at the store, it was a long drive. There wasn't a mom and pop store down at the corner. In fact, my grandmother usually shopped when she had the opportunity in Connecticut, which was maybe 20 miles away, the nearest town. I can't remember the name. Earl was one of the threads that tied the community together. He was trusted by all. People told him news that they wanted passed through the community. People could leave a note on the kitchen table. Earl, you may gallon of kerosene and please feed pigs. And he would. He'd go out and feed pigs, or the cows or the chickens or whatever. And it's occurred to me, by the way, he became ill when I was about 15. And you can guess who took him in and just took care of him. My grandmother did. We had a huge house. And she had a huge old house and built as a roadside inn in the 1850s. Nobody came down that road. So my great-grandfather bought it out of the Civil War. Lots of bedrooms. And another part of the story is, when I was 6 or 7 or 8, when I'd go and spend a few days, there was usually somebody there at the dinner table. And she'd introduce me. At the table, they were staying there, visitors. And I finally asked her one Monday or Tuesday. My dad had dropped me off to spend a few days. And I followed her into the kitchen. There were two elderly women there at the table. And I said, Grandma, why are they here? And she said, because they need a place to be. And I remember that. It struck me as such a simple answer to a complex question. Later in the day, she said, we have lots of room. We have all the wood we need to keep the house warm. And we have all the wood we grow. tying that back to Earl Johnson, do we have people like that in our communities today that are trusted, that serve that kind of a role on the community? I wish we did. You leave your back open, Earl's gonna walk in, and you don't have to call him Ed. Well, you couldn't, there was no point. I think you get my point. We've lost an awful lot. And if there's anything we can do, is to try to give help in the community. And I guess I'll end the story with that.
We're actually running over, so.
Yay!
Unless somebody has a burning desire to read something else.
Could I just share one little quote?
Sure.
Something that I read last night.
Yes.
Ever since we moved to DTV, I have not been watching TV. And it's been very nice to hear what the folks did in the olden times. And I know my candle. I like the flickering of candles. And last night I was reading in a book, it was a quote by Helen Keller that said, when we are looking towards the light, there's no need to fear dark shadows. So I just wanted to share that. It's a new year. Thank you.
Thank you,
Ray. I'm going to close with a poem called Good Morning. We wake up late on the morning after the storm. All evening, the weather reports had predicted knee-deep snow. So why rush to get up for work or school? We wake up late without alarm clock or traffic noise. Before I bother to glimpse outside, I feed the cat, make the coffee, fix a bowl of cereal. It's not avoidance. I can tell from the brightness around the window shades that all the world is snow, that the sun is high, the sky is blue, and that nature has imposed a bright, calm, clear sanity upon the planet. I take my time.